I'd like to acknowledge Australia's First Nation people as the traditional custodians of the land, and for this episode in particular, the Wurundjeri Nation. I pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
Every day is a victory for the health of the ecosystem we work in. You know, there's something, why do you get out of bed? And well, one of the reasons I love to get out of bed is because I feel that personally that this is the right thing we're doing with the land that is not ours, it is for future generations.
This is Over a Glass. I'm Shante Whale. Justin Jarrett has had close to 30 years with his feet firmly embedded in the ground. A pioneer of organic viticulture, he and his wife Pip have moved mountains to farm sustainably. Their sanctuary is Seesaw Wines in Orange of New South Wales. Hi, Justin. Thanks for joining me.
Absolute pleasure, Shante. And that's a really big introduction.
Well, it's completely worthwhile and very true, in fact. Now, tell me, you are in the middle of vintage, people screaming at you, grapes desperately needed to be picked, and you've decided to come in for a breather to talk to me. So I feel very honoured. Thank you.
No, look, you know, I think the thing about coming to do this is that part of being in wine is conversation. And during vintage, the conversations can become short and not necessarily expansive. So I'm really looking forward to this opportunity.
You're too kind. Now, tell me a little bit about where you were born and kind of how you fell into the vineyard, I suppose.
So I actually was born in Canberra. A long time ago, so long ago that they unfortunately blew the hospital up where I was born. But eventually, you know, I did 10 years in Canberra. And then interesting, even that part is part of my journey, which is that when I was born, Canberra was about 32,000 people. Lake Burley Griffin was just getting built. And so we assumed as kids that we grew up in a country town and not the nation's capital. My father was a dentist. My grandfather was a farmer, and we've had a long heritage of farming in our family. But eventually, I end up in Young when I was 17 or 18, and working in cherries. And then I went off to university and studied ag science, where I met Pip. And the two of us dated and went out together for about 10 years, and then we get married. But before we got married, I was living in Young. Pip was in Batlow, had been in Batlow as an apple horticulturalist, and we decided to move to Orange to make that our new home and new base. And just before that all occurred, it was 1989, and some of the big companies, so for some of people who might, so you know, today most people recognize it as Penfolds, but in actual fact at that point in time was a company called Southcorp, was looking for vineyards to be planted in the hilltop regions. We had a meeting with them and got a contract to grow grapes for that on our home farm in Young. And I actually planted a small vineyard on another friend's place in 1989, so that's beginning to be the introduction. Decided that I should travel a little bit more before I committed to planting our own grapes. And so we went overseas in 1990, came back in 91, and realised that family farming, like Dad and I were good mates, but we weren't going to be good mates if we continually farm together. chose to move to Orange. And part of that, when we moved up here, was that Southcorp actually said, would we be interested in planting a vineyard in Orange? And Pip and I took that opportunity to do that.
Wow. Well, I'm so glad that grapes found you rather than, you know, apples winning over and you making cider, as much as I do enjoy a cider now and again.
I was going to say, we should write it out. We actually wrote out a business plan for grapes, apples and protea, being flowers. Yeah, and we chose the wine industry as the industry to put our efforts into. And, you know, sadly enough, the apple industry has, in that same period of time, gone through a massive decline in Orange, to the point where there were 330 growers when I first moved here in 1991, till there's only 11 left.
Oh, yeah. That's incredibly – it is actually incredibly sad. I remember the first time I learned about the region of Orange, my first fact was, you know, it's called Orange, but it's actually known for apples. And I said that for a long time till the point where I thought, you know, I don't know if that's true anymore. It's really known for wine.
Yeah, which is great. And historically, the wine industry was as large as the apple industry in the 1940s. Heading in the 1950s, and in fact, since it worked out that the first commercial vineyard was planted in Orange before the Barossa.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. Now, tell me a little bit about that first vintage, and why did you decide to go to organics? When did that come? When did that conversation start, and why?
The conversation starts while we're at university. Sydney University at that point in time was teaching agricultural science, and that was a very much a science-based degree. So you have a problem, you solve it by working out what chemicals would cure a disease, what the soil needed was which chemicals to put into the soil. So it was very much there's a problem, we solve it by what I called hard science. I was actually at Hawkesbury Ag College, and I was doing systems agriculture. And the whole idea of systems agriculture is, when there's a problem, it's nature's way of telling us something, that there's something wrong. So, the best example I always have is that most people have driven through New South Wales, have seen at times the beautiful purple flower, which is called Patterson's Curse in New South Wales, and they see that tourists think, oh, look at that. Flowers. The farmer sees that as a complete weed. It's damaging the livestock and it's reducing your productivity. Hawkesby then taught us that why, to ask the simple question, why is the weed there in the first place? And the answer is because there's a copper deficiency in the soil, and the role of Patterson's Curse in a natural system is to actually drag copper out of the soil, put it into its leaves, and as the plant dies, it actually is fixing the copper deficiency that's occurring. Sydney University's solution to it was to spray it with MCPA, which is a broadleaf chemical, reintroduce pasture, get competition going, etc. Now, both have a result. It's just that Pip and I, when we looked at it and thought, well, we much prefer the first one, which is to work with the natural system and work out why things were going. So then we were then on this path of, righto, every time we use something that is a chemical, are we doing damage? Are we on a destruction, or have we read things differently from what we should be? And so in our heart, we knew that long-term strict use of chemicals has only limited life in any system, and we have to actually explore other systems to be able to be, you know, sustained farming into the future.
Incredible. I mean, when you say it like that, it just seems to all make sense. But it's not necessarily, an option for everyone in wine, depending on which region, you know, they're a part of. What was the process of your first vineyard was in 1995, and you were growing grapes for other people? Was the conversation of converting to organics something that they were interested in, or did you have to push against boundaries?
No one was interested. It's actually quite funny. So if you go back to those 90s, the perfect vineyard was manicured, and the vine was bare, the leaves are green. It's the picture post, you know, the picture perfect poster that every Instagram shot wants to have, and everyone loves it. I can still remember one of the South Cook guys walking in and saying, well, what are you doing in this block? And it was a block of Marsan. So our first block we took was Marsan, and I said to him, well, you know, we've actually, in this block we are trimming three times, we are doing all this extra work to reduce the vigor of the plant to maintain it being open so we can spray properly. My belief is by leaving the grass underneath, we can pull back the vigor. And he said, well, you know, this just looks untight and this is ridiculous. What are you thinking, you know? And automatically downgraded the fruit, even though it hadn't been harvested. But that was just their automatic reaction, was this is not what we want in viticulture. and therefore we don't want that anymore. So there was a lot of pushback. And this, look, there still is. There's, you know, it's not, and what I would say is that organics is a journey, just like farming with chemicals is a journey. There are lots of things we don't have answers for, but we just feel that as a family that it's a path to go down that is better for the soil, better for our communities, better for mine. You know, it has risks, it has problems, it has pushback, it has market perceptions, etc. But in the end, if we are achieving better soil, happier employees, then it's, you know, basically the job's done because the wine will be better anyway.
It's a massive undertaking to convert. It's a lovely idea, but as you would know, it's not such an easy process. Tell me a little bit about that process of converting the vineyard over, and when did you first start to notice any effects or any change at all?
So the main thing is the first part of conversion from a certified point of view takes 3 years. You've got to remove all man-made chemicals from the system. So that means that under vine, we're not allowed to use, you know, the herbicides that are classically used, being Roundup, Spray Seed, Bastr. And that is the major problem. It isn't the actual disease control. Disease control, we revert back to the very traditional use of sulfur and copper. We have restrictions on the amount we can use, but those chemicals are naturally occurring and have been in viticulture for thousands of years. They're not new, and we just have to work on how to actually time it right. And this is where it gets really interesting, because what we do is we have weather stations at every property, we have disease models at every property, and we are using really high-tech science, drones and fiber block, to give us tools to make a decision on when to spray for disease. And so that actually has been quite easy, I would say, not that as difficult. The underlying area is the problem, because under certain conditions, certain plants love to grow. And as you convert from a traditional bare ground underneath the vine to 100% ground cover, nature itself wants to fix the problem. So you get all these invasive weeds, you get plants that you don't want in your vineyard suddenly popping up because you, when they used to pop up, you would spray them. Now they're there to do their job. So then we've gone through, we went through a stage of saying, right, we'll go back to the old days and using a plow or some sort of mechanical soil disturbance device. And then after a few years of that, we went, you know, we've actually got nowhere. We've just removed chemicals for a machine. We are still destroying the soil. So we have to then work on how do we get this to be underneath the vine to be 100% green, 100% growing. And that has been the biggest problem. So we've called from undervines mowers. We've now got undervine whippersnippers. And we're slowly working our way through it. What we did notice is that the first 3 years going back into what we call organic farming, there is a massive reduction in yield. The system has to find its own balance again. So I would actually say in our case, some of the blocks have taken 7 years to go back into a natural balance, where we can show that, you know, year 5, 6, the yield was down, the amount of money being spent was more than a conventional vineyard, etc. But that Marcel block that I talk about, now yield is back to where we are accepting it as economically viable, and the amount of inputs that we put into it are now getting lower. So, you know, in our case, a minimum of 3 years, but I reckon it takes about 7 years before you get back into balance.
So in terms of what you did in, you know, until that moment's there, you were growing grapes, you were selling them on to other people. What would you do before you actually released Cecil wines?
So we were selling them on to other wineries mainly. But we did start our own small label called Jarrett's of Orange in 1999. So we were starting to put some of our grapes into the bottle. It's just that we you know, Pip and I decided Just trying to think of all the years. It is a long way back, isn't it? In the we actually were exporting Jarrodson's orange to America, and we had some domestic sales of that. We had a little bit into Sydney, so we were beginning to put our own warrants out. We decided, I think it was in going 2006, 2007, somewhere around there, that for us to be successful as a label, I had to spend a lot of time on plans. We've been 2002, 2003. And we had three little kids. And our part of being a farmer is that we want to spend time with our kids. So we chose to actually shelve the brand until the kids and all have grown up, so that we would have time to, you know, go and coach the soccer team, go and watch the run, go and listen to the singing and the violins and all those lovely things that parents love. So we did that. And then, by doing that, we made a thing that we were going to be great, great growers. We were going to really work on the vineyard farming system. And we end up with 22 different wineries purchasing fruit orchards from all over Australia, mostly New South Wales, but not entirely. And so we concentrated on that business. And one of those was Cecil Wines, which had already started in 2007. We were its major supplier of fruit. And then in 2012, the guys that had the brand came and said, look, would you take it on 100%, because they wanted to do their own thing? And we went, yep, we're ready now to really go put our energies into a brand, because we feel like we've got a long way with the vineyard and our knowledge of how to grow grapes on our site.
That's so interesting, because it's not normally how things come to pass, but knowing that you knew the site so well, it's everything you did, and then the brand kind of came after, is really interesting.
Yeah, look, it's actually, I've never thought of it that way. I suppose what I have thought about sometimes is there are some vineyards that used to tell me how good the fruit was from this flock, and then they would come out. Some wineries, and so they probably did all our learning for us from a wine point of view. But yeah, the other side of it is that to maintain a farming operation in Orange, we have to value add. The role, you know, I don't think anyone who's possibly listening to this podcast doesn't know this, but to be a contract grape grower in the current 10 years, in fact, almost back to 2004, has been really difficult. It hasn't been an enviable position to be in. Possibly the exception to that is obviously somewhere like Tasmania, where the prices of grapes seem to be high enough to sustain a growing business, just a grape growing business. But in Orange, to stay in vineyards, to stay in that type of farming, you have to value add.
In terms of your whole philosophy of farming and the space that you have, you talked a little bit about kind of under vine management. As a diversity of species in the surrounding environments important? Is that something that you look to? Is that a practice that you're involved in?
Absolutely. So all our farms, remember, we have three of them, have full-on farm plans, and we've done tree planting all the way back since 1991. We've got corridors, wildlife corridors on creeks fenced out. We've got waterways fenced, et cetera, et cetera. And if when people ask me why, the answer is that I don't know a human who can live on one thing. And I often equate a farm to a human. We need a diversity of food. We need different, we do need vegetables, proteins, et cetera, et cetera. Well, a landscape or a farm is a living unit, and it needs exactly the same. It needs to diversification. Otherwise, it becomes sick. So I always go back to that movie where the guy ate a Big Mac every day for X number of days. Can't remember the name of it. What happened to the poor bloke? He ends up in hospital. If you're running a living farming system and you don't have diversification in there, diversification of plant life, diversification of insects, animals, birds, etc., it will end up being sick. And it is so important to have that diversification. So in our case, multiple number of different species under the vine. We have treed areas, we have grassed areas. We do run a sheep enterprise on as well. So from literally yesterday, some of the sheep were in the Shiraz block, and we will now graze the vineyard for 6 or 7 months, which in itself brings in a whole lot of different bios, you know, different gut activities from the sheep, digesting the grass, etc. So it all is so important to any farming system. And, you know, this is not just from vineyards. It's actually a bigger picture that, unfortunately, we haven't quite grasped across the whole of agriculture.
Yeah, still a ways to go. In 2019, Seesaw was certified organic and vegan. What was that moment like? Did you breathe a sigh of relief, or did you just think there's still lots of work I need to do?
No, absolutely did not breathe a sigh of relief. Our first certification is 2007, so that shows you how long the whole thing has taken. This is why we love it. There are so many things we just still don't know. And therefore, there is no breathe a sigh of relief. There is forever learning and journeys to be done. And the thing that I suppose we could do at that point, when I think back to that day, was we could actually then say, look, 100% of this production system now is, you can check. Whatever we say has been checked by a third party, so believe it. If you don't believe us, believe the third party. And that's a good spot to be. What I would say is that with certification comes no small amount of paperwork. You know, I'll just give you a little example. The Australian Certified Organic System is not recognised by Japan, not recognised by the US. The EU recognises 80% of it, but doesn't recognise 20% of it. Every single country we export to at this point in time has their own separate rules. The Australian government can change the rules at any one point in time. And you some days you do think, the system is missing the point, and the point being better health, healthier soils, better products, better healthier people, and yet we seem to get bogged down heavily in paperwork to prove what we're doing, and then to be able to sell that product into a market that requires us to say, if we say we're organic, you have to be able to prove that's true, vice versa.
You've got to be steadfast and you've got to want it, is what I am gathering from that. But I don't envy you.
Look, I think the thing is that Pip and I get out of bed and we're happy with what we're doing. We're happy with how we farm, and we're not happy where we are. We'd like more soil carbon. We'd like more tree planting. There's a program we want to go through before we depart the earth. But we feel that that every day is a victory for the health of the ecosystem we work in. And there were setbacks in that system. You know, the 1920 drought with the smoke and the fires. You know, that was a really hard year for our farming system, because even though we had destocked and reduced everything down, everything went backwards. And then you have to realize that that is a natural system. And then we must be allowed within the system to recover to get back to its full health. And there's something, why do you get out of bed? And one of the reasons I love to get out of bed is because I feel that personally that this is the right thing we're doing with the land that is not ours, it is for future generations.
I love that. I want to talk a bit about innovation and exploration. You've done some work with Sydney Uni in their robotics program. I imagine that is a lot of trial and error and probably a lot of time and effort involved with you. What are the benefits of programs that you get involved in with things like drones and robotics? Why do you do that?
That's a really good question. Why? Initially, the first time we saw robots, we saw them as a solution to a labor problem. And that this is the future, that in the future, the machines will be, running the vineyards and doing all that sort of work. And we still think that there is, we still believe that there is an absolute role for unmanned tractors, and that that will be part of Australia's solution to our labour problem. The amount of time, if you imagine every day just having the same job and doing the same thing, and then off to the side there's something, the buzz is happening somewhere. Well, it's nice to be in a bit of buzz, isn't it? So when you sit down with the professor from Sydney Uni and he talks all about robots and AI and all that sort of things, we're the starry-eyed kids are going, oh, wow, this is really interesting. Or we can go back into the room and talk about tannins and oaks and, viruses in vines. So there's that side of it, which is that it's bringing us out of our comfort zone. It's interesting. It's doing different things. We also believe in the end, the vineyard for the future, which is what the main reason we work with these guys is that the vineyard for the future will have these machines in it, and we need to understand what that future looks like so we're preparing ourselves for it. So if you're going to plant a new vineyard and you've spoken to Sydney Uni and they've said, look, we've got a real problem with the way this vineyard's set up for the lasers and the GPS to work, do we then, knowing that within 20 years, because we're planting vines at the moment, they're going to be in full use for the next 20 to 30 years, do we make some fundamental design changes so that in 5 years' time, if the innovation has come through, that we're able to easily adopt it?
Such big questions, and I imagine a little bit of that is poking in the dark, but it's nice to be having those conversations and get the insight. I heard a rumor that at some stage they were developing a self-propelled robot that would scan fruit to kind of give an accurate yield estimate, which would obviously save time and labor for growers, but that actually, in fact, you being able to walk through the vineyards and just clock with your eyes, you are more accurate than the robot. Is that right?
That's true. but I think in the end that I would now begin to lose. So that was 10 years ago, and the whole computing system wasn't up to a good knowledge. But it's like any AI. If you constantly do it time after time after time, and the one system does that across the world, its learning is exponential compared to mine. So, but eventually that machine will win. Justin was winning quite easily 10 years ago, but today, that actual research project has been taken up by Pernod Ricard in New Zealand, and then using it in France and Argentina. So we know in the next couple of years that will be very accurate compared to Justin.
Well, not quite replaceable yet, though, I don't think. I want to talk a bit about your community involvement, because you have been involved with the New South Wales Wine Industry Board. You've played a big mentor role for a lot of people in the industry, and I think one of the best testaments of someone's character is when you have their peers, rave about them and what they do for the industry, and no more than you have I heard a name mentioned. So tell me about a little bit about why you are on some of those boards and what they teach you.
Well, once again, that was was what I was expecting to hear. The boards themselves have been, once again, it's stepping off the farm. It's that experience of saying, hey, there's a bigger world out here. And I must admit, the WGGA at the time, which is now Australian Wine and Grape, meant that, four times a year I had to go to Adelaide or Canberra. I got to go to Renmark, Mildura, all sorts of places to sit in rooms to discuss the big picture issues of the wine industry. I'd advise anyone who is passionate about 20 or 30 years in this industry to push yourself that little bit harder and see the bigger picture. And it, really was, you know, like, I, you know, as people say, Justin, I've heard this in the Coonawarra. Well, you know, I can ring up Pete Ballinase there, or I can ring up, guys in Tasmania, and they answer the phone because, you know, we've all got to know each other quite well. So it's been a really positive thing. When I was a kid, people took time to give me opportunities. I am dyslexic, and you can get put in a pigeonhole very easily, struggling to read and write. And there were people who took their time to see that there was more to it than that. And I've always felt that it's important for me to take time to give back to other people, because that's what someone, you know, not just one person, but several people took their time to say, hey, there's other ways of doing things. You just got another F for English. But that doesn't mean you're an idiot, you know. Let's work on that. And, you know, as an industry, we're Australia's doing it tough at the moment. And what I see is there are people who still are passionate about growing grapes and making wine, passionate about marketing, about understanding how our whole system is. And if we don't have those young people be assisted through, well, you know, it's not a great ending to the next 20 years. So it's really important that we take that time and effort to help anyone who's interested. Anyone. And these days, if you put your hand up, you probably get a phone call from me saying, hey, what do you need? This is, you know, 15 years ago, I would always take the phone call.
It's wonderful to hear. The story that comes to mind actually was from a good mate, Jake Sheedy, actually down at CISO Wines, who talked to me a little bit about some of the issues he'd encountered and who we would call. And his kind of words about you was that when he was in a pickle, you would not only just help give him advice, but you'd run through the problem with him and get him to kind of help solve his own issues by analyzing. And he said it gave him a lot of self-belief, but also, you know, just working through a problem with someone that had like mind, had the time for him, was really instrumental in him becoming, you know, the winemaker and viticulturist he is now. And stories like that are wonderful to hear, because there is such a learning curve, isn't there, when you first start out, and sometimes you're not sure who you should be asking that silly question to.
Absolutely. And let's just put that there publicly. Then the fact that Jake Sheedy has reduced your social status in the world, but that's okay. You'll probably edit that out, but that's all right. I always can remember when in Orangeville, we planted grapes early on. There were lots of pioneers in the Orange wine region, and we used to all share our problems and share our knowledge, and it was so important to where we are today. And when I look at any, you know, the thing about helping someone is that it can help you as well. And the ability to help someone solve their own problems is greater than giving them a solution. It's that whole, you know, give a man a fish, feed him for a day versus show him how to fish, feed him for life. What I was taught years ago when I was young with the managers, don't walk into your boss's office with a problem, walk in with solutions. And until you have those solutions, don't walk in, because your boss doesn't actually want your problems. He wants to be able to make decisions on solutions. And then later on, when I was doing some really interesting reading, there was a Buddhist monk who would pose a question to his studies. They weren't allowed to speak until they had 32 separate answers to that question. So they had to go away and come up with 32 different answers to a question. And once they had that, they could then come and converse. And besides that being just weird, but the thing it taught me was there's no right answer, and that's view. So there is no right answer. There's ways of doing things, and different approaches. There's no right answer in one. But having a conversation, working through different things, you generally can get closer to what could be a solution.
I suppose that's why they spend so much time in quiet, is because they are thinking about all those things rather than just having verbal diarrhea and letting just thoughts spew out of their mouth. So there is something in that, that's for sure.
Correct. unlike journalists. Is that what you're trying to say? She's like to talk?
Very much so. I'd like to know, you know, your wines are incredibly vibrant. The whole range of wines are remarkable. What wines do you really enjoy making at the moment? What's piquing your interest in Orange?
So first of all, just I really want to acknowledge that Monica Grave, who's come on as our winemate, has really taken just, and I just think that your comment then was really a reflection of where we wanted to be, but we were struggling to get there under my tutorage, and Monica has really managed to take that whole idea, you know, a wine should represent the fruit and the fruit comes from the vineyard. Always, Chardonnay is the number one variety in Orange, but Justin, the old farmer who loves to see a value-added product, and just really enjoy Prosecco, which Monica will turn over and go, oh, my God. But, you know, we've had a hot week, and the simplicity of Prosecco is what I love. So in the vineyard, it's a great crop to grow, yields well, it's reasonably disease-free, and then the winemaking of it is the secret to it is don't complicate it. And that's actually quite difficult. The secret to that wine is if it's right in the vineyard and we can really handle it well throughout the winery, it comes out the other side. Literally, I say to people, you can taste the beautiful crisp mountain air in it that comes out of Orange through that. And then the vice versa, Chardonnay, you know, we play with different clones. We've got different aspects. We've got different oak. We've got, you know, barrel fermented, whole bunch, et cetera. So the complexity of that makes it really interesting as well, because that's actually takes a lot of thought. You know, you've got to have that think, I would like to have my wine look like this at the end of by bottling. You've got to have that pre-thought in your mind and then be working back. And so that they're both from both different ends of the spectrums of what is what I really enjoy.
And I'd also like to know, when you're not drinking your own wines, is there a wine, and I'm going to say one, of your peers that you're enjoying drinking at the moment?
There's a Swinging Bridge has this wine called Tempino, which is a blend of Tempranillo and Pinot, and chill that down a bit, and I really do enjoy that as, you know, as well. But like most people in wineries, we do explore. We do, I would say, unfortunately, not unfortunately, but we do drink a lot of our own wine. And someone asked me why, and I said, well, basically we grow our own lamb. We have our own vegetables. We grow, you know, most of the things that we put on the table at Nolet have been produced for us. So we do that. There's a Pooley's Pinot that comes from McLaren's block. It's got this phenomenal flavour in it that I've never seen in any other Pinot. Well, I can get a bottle out of Lover as well.
I love that. My final question is, if you could only drink three drinks for the rest of your life, what would they be and why, Justin?
Oh, obviously, I'd probably drink water because it'll keep you alive for longer. No. I've got to have my coffee every day. Otherwise, I don't actually survive until 11 o'clock. I do love at lunchtime a beautiful, fresh green tea. So just said, you know, I just love that. And for lots of people who don't realise, tea industry, not the tea bags, but the tea industry is in itself as interesting as the wine industry from a different flavour, postal, different places, et cetera. So green tea, cup of coffee, and definitely a cool climate or a Chardonnay.
I like that. I can get on board with all of those things. Justin, it's been such a pleasure. I'm a big fan of yours. Love what you do. And a shout out to Pip too, who I'm sure is probably turning all the cogs and a huge part of the success of Justin Jarrett. But thank you so much for spending some time. I'll let you get back out in the vineyard and I hope our paths cross again soon.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you, Chantal, for the opportunity.
This is Over a Glass. I'm Shantae Whale. Stay tuned for more stories from the world of wine and drinks. Listen in every Thursday on your podcast app. Follow us on Instagram at overaglasspod and contact us at overaglass@deepintheweeds.com.au.